You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Meet the Farmers. I've travelled a few miles up the road to Suffolk to meet my guest today, who is William Kendall. William's not your typical farmer, but then I'm still not sure who really is. He's an environmentalist and entrepreneur, as well as an organic farmer. He studied law at Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, and later travelled to France to complete an MBA. He's had short careers as an army officer in the Royal Anglian Regiment, as a barrister, and then as an investment banker. In 1990, he became managing director of the New Covent Garden Soup Company, which he led for 9 years before selling it on. He subsequently built up the then small organic chocolate business, Green and Blacks, which he and his partners sold at Cadbury's in 2005. He wears several different hats and is or has been a director or advisor to a number of businesses, including Adnams, Knockcuts and the Grosvenor Estate. He's also chair of Causton Press. William and his wife Miranda farm organically at Maple Farm in Kelsale, where they have developed a successful example of local food production and marketing. Williams also goes on. Williams, deputy lieutenant for Suffolk, founder director of the Aubra Food and Drink Festival, a director of Aubra Music, which produces the world-famous Aubra Festival and Snake Proms, and a council member of the Suffolk Agricultural Association, which puts on the Suffolk Show. He campaigns on a wide range of issues connected with food and the countryside. I could go on, but I think we'd better hear from William himself now. William, thanks so much for giving me some of your time. And because I know it's very precious, and I think that's probably one of my first questions to you, is what is your way of time management, and how do you manage to have so many different hats?
Well, I mean, you've exposed me already as somebody who's not very good at saying no to things, and perhaps I'm rather unfocused.
I'm the same.
I find things fascinating. I find people who have got interesting ideas. I find people fascinating, and I like helping. And I do try and limit myself so that I can, when things go wrong, which inevitably they do, especially if you're working with smaller organisations, to leave yourself the leeway to get involved in a deeper way when needed. And that's, you know, that's the problem, is sometimes things go wrong on multiple fronts at the same time, and you do worry about letting people down. I started life as a detail person, as you said in that sort of kind introduction, that I was a barrister, and you know, I'm sort of a natural barrister. I'm a lawyer. I look at the detail. But, you know, there are times when you have to rely on others to look at the detail. You cannot be involved in all these things and check that the I's are all dotted and the T's. So I sort of try and find places where that is less of an issue, and where a sort of a broad approach to what an organisation needs is something I can add. And those that really need real sort of in-depth involvement, sadly, I probably don't get as involved these days.
I'm interested in labels and the way that people label themselves. I blindly pointed you as environmentalist, entrepreneur, yeah, organic farmer, three labels that have very sort of distinct connotations and views of. How do you self-identify? Do you identify with any of those labels?
Well, I do, but I mean, we all seek labels, don't we? And I think it's a danger. I think, you know, we force our children into, you know, my children are reaching the stage where they're sort of choosing careers at the moment. And you know, you say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And rather than saying, what do you enjoy doing and what are you good at? Because actually, yeah, those features probably could thrive in so many different roles. I happen to know that I loved selling things when I was a child. I loved having a stall at the end of the farm drive, but no one ever said, do you want to sell things in the future? Do you like selling things that people like buying? Because that was, if they had, I might well have not had quite as many careers in my 20s. So yes, I am an environmentalist, but you know, my interests just sort of pop above the surface in a form where I can put that particular label on what I do. You know, I say I'm a farmer. I mean, your introduction talked about there never being a typical farmer. A lot of people say, well, you're not a proper farmer because you do lots of other things. Well, I mean, I was born a farmer. I grew up on a farm. My family had been farming forever. So why aren't I a farmer? Yeah. But you know, I kind of do it almost to sort of challenge people.
Do you find you have to defend that?
Well, I find myself defending it. I don't know whether I have to defend it. I'm not. I'm quite comfortable with what I do in life. But I find the sort of stereotypical farmer image as being totally inappropriate for the industry and totally inappropriate for the future of the industry. So, you know, you set up this sort of challenge of what is a typical farmer, and I completely agree. I think in a way we have got used to a typical farmer, whether it actually is true on the ground. But, you know, a typical farmer in East Anglia is somebody who plants, you know, a lot of one particular crop, which is totally dependent on a public subsidy, which is largely fed to animals that aren't designed to eat it. And then they go away for large chunks of the winter and, you know, go skiing and buy a new Range Rover. And, I mean, of course, this is horrible, horrible stereotype.
In a previous episode with Matt Naylor up in Lincolnshire, we were talking about exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Apparently that is what a good farmer is. That is what a typical farmer is. Somebody who, you know, has reduced their farming to such a sort of a simple activity that they can actually leave it for large chunks of the winter. I mean, good luck to them. But that is not what farming is. And that's certainly not what the public expects of farmers. And as the public is largely paying for farmers at the moment, and we want them to carry on doing that, we probably need to, you know, adjust our own self-image and then go out and communicate it to the wider world. I happen to think I am a typical farmer. I love farming. I love the land. I love producing food. I love talking to customers. And, you know, I get an enormous amount out of all the other activities I get involved with, which confront me with what customers want and with challenges from other industries. My favourite farmer was somebody, I was a postman. I was walking in Austria a few years ago in a beautiful sort of summer rural landscape. Yeah. And the postman turned up and I watched him delivering the letters to somebody's, you know, nice house in the countryside, and then put open the back of his van and there were all the produce from his farm. I thought, here's a smart guy. You know, he's producing, it was all organic, he's producing lovely stuff, and he's using the state post office van to deliver everything, I'm sure entirely legitimately. Yeah. But in Britain, that sort of model of a farmer would be seen as somebody, you know, a hobby farmer or something else, whereas, you know, I see him just as a smart farmer.
Mixing that entrepreneur label and that farmer label, do you think that growing up on a farm was a good preparation for business?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant preparation for business. Growing up and working on a farm, you're never allowed to relax. I always say that if I see farming on someone's CV, I'm going to give them a job, whatever it is that they've done since. But I mean, I always say dairy farmers' children are the best people to employ because they don't know what a weekend is. They don't know what a bank holiday is. So they're incredibly hardworking, diligent. They're used to sort of sorting out problems without sort of waiting for someone else to help them. Because, you know, in farming, usually there isn't someone else to help, or they're a very long way away. So you try and fix things, sometimes in a slightly bodgy way. And I always joke about, you know, being woken up in the middle of the night. I grew up a mile and a half from the A1. And, you know, if you heard the cattle are out, you didn't hang around. You just jumped out of bed because you knew you had about 5 minutes before they were going to cause a major traffic accident. I always think other people hearing something like that would probably look for a number in the yellow pages, cattle return services. But in farming, you know, you've got to do it yourself. And I think in entrepreneurial businesses, on the whole, it's about doing things yourself and pulling together with a small team. So to me, it's the most fantastic training, and I'm quite certain that's why I've ended up where I have and why the worlds of City of London and the Balm, whilst I enjoyed them enormously and got a great deal out of them, seemed alien to me. Because they just didn't feel like that world that I'd grown up with, which was just small teams pulling together.
Why law in the first place? Why did you opt for that as your initial path?
Well, I don't know. I think I was always told that I was good at arguing and quite enjoyed standing up and speaking. And so, you know, you don't know what you want to do. And I ended up reading law at Cambridge, and I'd had an institutional life. I'd been to a typical boys' school, and I'd been in the army, and then I'd been at Cambridge, and the bar enabled you to sort of carry on.
The next natural next
natural,
step.
Natural step. So, you know, it wasn't very imaginative of me. It just sort of kicked the can down the road for another year or so. I mean, I did enjoy it, and I still enjoyed the law, and I got a great deal out of it, and I did enjoy standing up in court and you know, arguing for my client. But I just felt it was a very... I mean, there was a particular moment when I was involved. I was about the fifth junior on a big case, and a bunch of well-known business people came in. It was about actually building the Channel Tunnel. And they were worried that they were about to lose the chance for the franchise, which they did. And we'd spent days and days, weeks and weeks, being up all night advising on their case. And we came in and the very senior QC who I was working with basically told them that they didn't stand a chance. And, you know, they chatted politely for an hour and then they left. And everyone in the room, all of the barristers, then said, well, I think that went out quite well, and went on to their next project. And I just realised I wanted to go out of the room and find out what the business people were going to do next. Yeah. You know, they had spent years and millions on this project. Yeah. And we had just told them that they had been successfully frustrated. Obviously, we cared while we were doing the case, but we were now going to move on to another case. And I just realised I'm more with the business people. So that was probably the moment when I realised I had to do something different.
How did you come to take over the new Covent Garden Soup Company?
I realised that I was fairly unemployable after the bar and a spell in the city. I went to business school. A lot of people at business school, which I loved and learned a huge amount at, a lot of the people at my business school were desperate to work in the City of London. They'd come from all over the world and particularly all over the rest of Europe. And I realised that I was just not like them, or like a lot of them. And so I needed to work in an environment where, not necessarily where I was in control of it, but where I was at the table, making decisions. And so I needed to find something where a 26 or 27-year-old person with a pretty good, you know, education could be at the table. I'm not a person who likes starting businesses. I mean, I started one or two since, but I much prefer sort of sorting existing things out. Yeah. And so I loved cooking. We're sitting in a kitchen of my wife's family farmhouse, and she inherited it when she was 15. So we had lots of friends here, which was great because there were no parents involved when we were young, but also a disaster because there were no parents to cook. So I learned to cook for huge crowds of people who would turn up at the weekends unexpectedly. And I worked out that making soup on a large scale was what I could see. I mean, I'd sort of got into cooking a bit out of just sheer greed and, you know, being on my own and you know, not meeting. I mean, I've got a lovely wife, but she's very smart. And she very quickly worked out that if she taught me to cook a couple of things when we were students together, then I might run away and do the cooking. So that's what happens in our marriage. But so I made lots of soup, and people said, you know, you should do this for a business. Then I discovered someone else doing it, and I kind of stalked them to the point where they let me come and talk to them. And I thought that I was going to be their sort of perfect solution to running their business. In fact, probably I was, but I was rather humbled when I showed them my CV with its, you know, business school, MBAs, barrister, all of that. They weren't remotely interested. All they were interested in was the fact that I was a farmer. Did I know where to buy cheap carrots? Which I did. So I was given a job for a month because that was all he was allowed from his backers to pay, you know, a new recruit to do. And after a month, I'd not only found cheap carrots, but I'd found cheap and delicious, you know, offcuts from every other vegetable that you need to make soup, because I grew up in East Anglia and I knew everybody. Yeah. And I knew that they were probably making, you know, there was a lot of very delicious stuff that was being taken away by the pig farmer at the end of the day, and nobody wanted to talk about it. But they couldn't deny it to me because I'd been around those farms before. I'd been doing another for years.
And then Green and Blacks.
Yeah.
Why Green and Blacks?
Well, that was. We sold Covent Garden Soup Company. I had sort of 10 difficult and then glorious years with a group of fantastic people, and we, you know, we were all about the same age, same levels of enthusiasm, and we finally realised we it was best to sell it. We had backers who'd stuck with us for quite a long time, and so everybody wanted to come out. Anyway, we were in our early 30s. We couldn't really retire. Well, we'd made a bit of money, but not enough to retire on. There were lots of people flattering us and say, oh, you could buy a much bigger business. And there were lots of sort of, you know, quite boring businesses that were being shed by much bigger businesses. And we looked at those. And then I actually met somebody through a friend at a supper party who was the entrepreneur behind what was called Whole Earth Foods, which was an organic brand, which had gone back to the 60s. And then he'd started making Green and Black's chocolate. So he had two brands, both of them not doing well financially, but both I felt absolutely sort of in the middle of where I thought the same sort of customer that we'd known at Covent Garden Soup was moving. People who wanted better quality food, people who were busy, but, you know, read articles about food, read about the problems that mass food was sort of, you know, enveloped in. And they were interested more and more in organic. I mean, when we were at Covent Garden Soup, we'd actually asked our customers, we'd done some consumer research about what have we developed, and all the results came back saying, well, we thought you were organic already. So in other words, you know, don't bring out a range and try and charge us more for what we thought we were getting already. So that was a fairly clear signal from the market. But it sort of showed me what more mainstream customers were thinking and where the organic movement should head to sort of, you know, to deliver what, you know, Middle England was looking for. So when we found a pair of, you know, well-formed but slightly sort of undernourished organic brands, it seemed the obvious thing to do was just take them on. So that's what we did. I mean, we kept the founder as a partner, who was a great asset as we built the business, but we bought a controlling stake in it and, you know, grew the businesses accordingly. We sold Whole Earth Foods after a few years and stuck with Green and Blacks because it was such a gem.
Before we talk farming proper, I just want to talk about some of your other interests. I'm currently drinking for the first time kombucha. And I'm really pleasantly surprised. Tell me about this enterprise.
So kombucha is, well, I won't tell you what kombucha is.
I will say, listeners, please search and do some research on it, because it's well worth looking up.
I mean, one of the problems with talking about kombucha, I mean, kombucha is it's made from tea, but it doesn't taste anything like tea. You can back me up on that. It's a delicious carbonated alternative to alcohol, and that's why I drink it. I mean, I come home, and this is, you know, I've been in constant search for something that I can drink instead of alcohol. I hope I don't have an alcohol problem, but I do have a problem in that, you know, I lead a busy life, and the temptation to open a bottle of wine on a Tuesday evening because I'm tired and drink more than a glass of wine when I don't really want to, because I want to get up early on Wednesday morning with a sort of, you know, clear head and all of that sort of stuff. But I just find it very difficult to find something that delivers what you want. And this is the drink that sort of does it for me. I find it, you know, delicious, refreshing, and any thought of needing to pull out a corkscrew and have a glass of white wine before supper just goes away.
Because, of course, you used to work with Advents.
I used to work with Advents. They were great.
Gone full circle.
Well, yeah, but they're a great brand. And, I mean, actually, I think their newest, most exciting drink is their zero alcohol 0.5% ghost ship. So it's you know, this whole...
That's a brilliant drink.
You wouldn't know it had no alcohol in it. And you know, people are more and more looking for low or zero alcohol alternatives, but we want dry drinks. We don't want lots and lots of sugar. So anyway, that's what kombucha is. I met an amazing young kombucha maker. She had a tiny little business in London. She was selling to about 12 shops. She was introduced by a mutual friend who's a restaurateur, quite a well-known restaurateur. And long and the short of it is we've put some money behind her. We've raised some money from friends, wider group of friends, and we've built a small brewery near Woodbridge in Suffolk. And it's going really well. It's huge in America. It's huge in Australia, the kombucha sector. So I'm quite certain it's going to be huge in the UK. I mean, whether we are part of that hugeness remains to be seen, but I hope we will be. I think we've done a pretty good job so far.
Tell me about the farm here at Kelsale.
My wife, Miranda, inherited the farm when she was 15. It was bigger. A lot of the land was sold off while she was a minor. So we were left with a few hundred acres. It had become an atypical cereal farm, in that it was a small cereal farm, virtually nobody working here. And we were competing in a world where people were producing cereals with much lower overheads. So we decided, when I bought Green and Blacks, that we should go organic. We knew that organic farming, from the research that was coming out at the time, was good for biodiversity, good for the environment. There wasn't much evidence that it was good for humans. Lots more of that now. And we went organic. It's very difficult going organic on land, particularly land that's been, you know, stripped of its nutrients and is in a poor state. You know, it's a bit like somebody who's been on a life support machine, and you just sort of turn off the life support machine and not doing very much else. So we produced our first crop of organic wheat 3 years later, and we sold it sort of proudly to the grain merchant, who then rang up about a week later and said, even though he'd taken endless samples, he wanted to send it back because it was, or not send it back, he wanted to dot the price, obviously, because it contained all sorts of impurities. And I was just so cross about it. I mean, obviously, I know the game. I mean, I've been in it long enough. But just somehow producing this lorry load of organic grain felt a lot harder than producing a lorry load of commodity conventional grain. So I vowed never to do it again and said we were going to have to buy our own flour mill because, you know, there was no way we were going to sell it in bulk.
Yeah.
So I found a flour mill. It took me about 2 years to bring one over. I found one in Austria and we brought a flour mill onto the farm and started milling our own grain. You know, it's a sort of long journey and suggests lack of strategy, which is entirely correct. It's more like a sort of, you know, 18th century novel. So we bought the flour mill. So it produced some very interesting conversations with local artisan bakers. But it also produced byproduct. The moment you start milling, you start having, you know, bran. And if you're making white flour, you end up with mids. And so we needed to get some livestock. So we got some hens. People loved the eggs. So we got some more hens, and then we got somebody who was an expert in organic hens, and we didn't really have enough hens for him, so we got some more hens so that we did have enough, and the eggs just kept selling. But what we discovered is that organic hens, and we have hens that are really, you know, organic, they're very outside. I decided that hens had to live in flocks of 100, no more, because I read that that was a sort of natural number for the species. So, you know, a typical organic flock is probably 2,000 up to 4,000. So we were kind of way below, very, very sort of, very, very simple systems, but actually very sort of labour-intensive systems. But the hens, when they're ranging, particularly in the winter, you know, tend to produce muddy eggs. So you wash the eggs, you're no longer allowed to sell the washed eggs anywhere other than the farm gate. So we started selling our eggs at the farm gate. People said, these are fantastic, but we've come all this way, can't we buy something else off you? So we started putting other things out from the farm. We had a box scheme at the time because we'd started doing vegetables undercover. And we realised that we should just be selling everything at the farm gate. So we put them into an old stable, and that's really our shop. It's a store. We call it the farm store. And it's gone from strength to strength, and you know, more and more people come and more people ask for different things. So it's encouraged us to produce more things. We had livestock. We had a few rare breed pigs, but we've got organic friends who graze their sheep and cattle here. So we sort of sell meat in the shop, small quantities of everything. We sell a bit of game from the shoot on the farm. We sell other people's things like the kombucha, which we can tell the story of. We sell, this time of year, we sell citrus because we made some friends with some amazing young organic farmers in Valencia who found a cool way of sending relatively small quantities of their citrus harvest over. So you know, they've got about 10 different things, including avocados. So we've created a shop with a story. We don't sell everything, but we sell... You know, you could certainly buy enough food for the weekend from us as long as you didn't come with a set list.
Yeah. And in comparison to those arable days, how many people are working on the place?
Well, a lot more. I mean, the arable days we were down to probably half of one full-time equivalent, and we're now up to about, I'm going to say, six or more full-time equivalents. But that number is made up of probably twice as many people who draw some of their livelihood, and I'd say a great deal of their pleasure, from working on this farm. So we've got a farm manager, probably what conventional farming would say an overqualified farm manager for so few acres, but we've actually created a very complex farming system. We've got lots of experiments going on. We've got one of the largest agroforestry schemes in the country here. We're heavily involved as organic farmers in soil restoration. So there's lots and lots going on, which does require thoughtful approaches. Even the poultry exercise, the egg exercise, is very different from a typical small egg producer who probably are producing their hens in a static hut, fairly automated, and we are moving our hens around the arable farming system for fertility, feeding them differently. And so everything we're doing is learning, is experimental. So you need a farm manager who enjoys experimenting. So it's a very different approach. And then we've got lots of other people. We've got young people. We've had several young people coming through the farm, some here at the moment, who have really struggled with the British school system, the secondary school system, and have been kind of written off. And they have absolutely flourished here in a way that I've seen people flourish, you know, throughout my life in farming. You know, they've either fallen for the livestock, they've fallen for the early responsibility. We've got a young guy at the moment, and I saw him a few weeks ago, and I said, how are you? He said, oh, I'm feeling terrible. I've been up all night. I've been sick. And I said, gosh, you know, well, thanks for coming in. He said, well, somebody had to feed the hens.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking, well, that's the sort of lesson that you're trying to get people to understand. And what other industries sort of breed that level of understanding of the importance of their work? So we've got those sorts of jobs. We've got single mothers working here, working flexi time, but all very, very committed to what we're trying to do here, which is produce delicious food which can be bought by our neighbours, and also, you know, play a part in biodiversity and making the place look more attractive and not leaving a heavy footprint on the landscape. So there's a sort of complex mission on the farm, but I think it's a very attractive place to work. I mean, it's a horrible place to work on a wet February morning, but, you know, people turn up to it. So, you know, I hope that explains what we're trying to do here. And people say, does it make money? Well, it does. I mean, I have been able to subsidise it with some of the other activities I do. But there's a lot of cross-subsidising going on in farming anyway. So, you know, if people want to criticise me for that, they can. But I can see how it can be. In fact, we made a profit last year. But I can see how this sort of farming can be profitable. It's more complex, but, God, it's much more fulfilling. And it's much more in tune with what the market requires and wants.
Let's be controversial, because I know you're fine with a bit of controversy. That large-scale model growing for the large-scale commodity market, is it appropriate for the UK?
I don't think it is. But if people want to do it, I'm all for letting people have a go at things, as long as it doesn't impact on their neighbours' lives. But I've been accused, you've heard me being accused, because we met at a conference, of producing sort of elitist food for a small number of affluent people, which I think is really unfair. We don't produce elitist food here. We produce food for people who do care about what they eat, but our shop and people coming to it are all types. And we've got plenty of, you know, very good value food in the shop. So I don't buy that. And anyway, there are lots and lots of people doing this at all levels of premium food and you know, catering for all incomes. But actually, at the conference you and I met at, the argument I thought was much better expressed by one of our fellow speakers, who was an Australian who done a presentation on big acre farming, big machinery farming, and it had gone down very well with the audience. There were lots of fantastic photographs. And then I stood up and said what I said and got accused of, you know, doing this elitist farming, and we weren't, you know, I wasn't doing anything about feeding the world. And he said, look, I think it takes all sorts, but if you in Britain think you can compete with me and my fellow farmers in Brazil and other parts of the world where there are broad acres and where there aren't country roads and there aren't neighbours who complain about things, where there aren't ancient monuments and ancient woodlands, if you think you can compete against that, then, you know, you're living in cloud cuckoo land. You know, he went on to say that, you know, we live in an affluent country where more and more people care about food with provenance. And we should be playing to our strengths. We haven't fed the world for hundreds of years. We haven't even fed ourselves for hundreds of years. And, of course, if there was a national crisis, then we would have to do something about it. But, you know, this idea that we should carry on fighting the Second World War in our industry, which is effectively what we're doing, to me is stark, raving bonkers.
So should we push aside the food security question?
The food security question is a global issue. But we produce enough food in the world at the moment anyway. We waste a great deal of it. We produce the wrong sort of food in the wrong sort of climates. The people who are starving because of political issues, not because of poor farming. They're starving in parts of the world where people don't feel confident to plant a crop because there is so much insecurity that they're not sure they're going to be around to harvest it. So, you know, I'm not about sweeping aside food security. But if we as East Anglian farmers think we've got a big part to play in food security, then we are deluded. You know, we should be working out how we secure our own farms in a world which is probably not going to be paying us subsidies to produce crops that actually most people don't really put a great deal of value on.
And again, rather going full circle from where we were starting, do you think that has a lot to do with identity? And actually, as farmers, we're food producers, we're producing quantity. There's a lot of conversations within farming circles, especially about yield rather than necessarily net profit. Is that part of it, do you think?
Well, I mean, we do identify ourselves as as big producers using big machinery, and generally sort of, you know, we are involved in an industry which is much more important than every other industry, which, you know, up to a point is true. But I do think that it is a hangover from the Second World War, where we're trying, you know, where we genuinely were at risk of starving. And we did plough up every acre, and we did everything we possibly could. But you know, those days are well and truly over. And I think we sort of continue that sort of dream at our peril. You know, we have to explain to the wider public what we are for. And when I go to farming gatherings, and that topic of conversation is always, you know, near the top of the list, it's about they are not listening to us. And it's because the problem is farmers do not listen to the public. The public are very sympathetic. They're very interested in how their food is produced. But they don't want to be told again and again and again that farmers are there to feed the world. So, you know, the very large tractor that went down the lane last night and took out the newcomer's hedge that they had just planted, you know, is not part of some great war effort. It's just another form of vandalism.
Do you think that moving away from land area-based payments is a good thing?
I think it's an inevitable thing. I think some sort of support of farming is a good thing, because I think there are many burdens that society expects farmers to pick up which haven't been properly valued in the past, but we have been compensated in another way. So I'm all for finding a way that actually more accurately reflects those particular burdens and takes them away from our primary goal, which is producing food. Because then I think we will start listening to what the market wants of us, but we will also be paid for whatever it is, whether it's flood mitigation, rainwater harvesting, carbon dioxide sequestration, allowing the public, all of those, you know, there are so many public goods that you know, farmers do deliver, just pulling endless rubbish out of our ponds on the roadside, all of those things. Who's going to do it if we can't afford to operate anymore? So we deserve to be paid. The public isn't going to pay us one by one for all of those activities. It makes sense that it comes through general taxation. So this idea that, you know, farming needs to stand on its own feet is, I think, a sort of very simplistic view of a very different industry from everything else. But I don't think it's helpful that we are paid according to our farming acreages or our farming activities when it comes to actually food production, because I think it just skews what we would otherwise do.
Now, we're recording this about a week before official Brexit Day. It'll be coming out post that date. I'm just interested in your take on the whole process so far and the situation that we're in.
Well, look, don't ask me what's going to happen. You're saying we are a week away from it. I'm actually going to march for a second referendum tomorrow, so declaring my hand. I do it with sort of heavy heart, but I just feel, you know, we've got to be able to do something. I'm not sure if a second referendum right now. I think there probably will be another referendum, but I think we've got to have something to have a referendum about. And having a referendum about whether we were right 2 years ago is probably not the right question. But it is a mess, but it was a predictable mess. I wasn't particularly fussed at the time. I mean, I did vote to remain, but I'd been very involved in criticising the EU. I was very involved in trying to avoid Britain joining the Euro some time back, and was sort of very public about all of that. So I was very involved with campaigning to keep Britain out of the Euro. So I'm not a passionate advocate for everything the EU does. But, you know, to me, there is a fundamental issue. Europe has decided that, or parts of Europe have decided that they want to go for closer and closer integration. Britain doesn't want to do that, not at the moment. Maybe it will do in the future, along with a lot of other countries. And so the fundamental question for Europe is, what is it like to be on the outer ring of a Europe that is integrating more closely? And that's the question that Britain should have been helping to answer, because it's the biggest country that wanted to know that. And there it could provide some leadership. And I'm quite convinced that that is actually the question it is asking. You know, that there is a role for countries that want to be close to the inner core of the EU, but not necessarily part of it. So, you know, my view 2.5 years ago was that, you know, we would end up where we end up, and I'm quite certain we will end up where we end up, which is, you know, being closely involved with Europe, having close trade links, whether we're part of a customs union, whether we're part of a single market, you know, remains to be seen. I'm pretty certain we probably will end up in that way. And, you know, a great deal of heat and steam and energy has been, in my view, wasted on you know, on an argument where we kind of knew what the answer was going to be already. So a long-winded way of saying, I don't know what's going to happen in the next week or the next months or whatever, but I'm pretty certain I know where we're going to end up. But a lot of political careers will have been destroyed along the way, and a lot of money wasted. I mean, the businesses I'm involved in, they're wasting so much money preparing for something that nobody wants to happen, or only a few people want to happen. I find that very frustrating and sad.
So really, I know that you cycle. How else are you able to switch off?
Well, I don't find it very difficult to switch off. Cycling is great, and if I'm trying to do something like, you know, write an article or prepare for a speech or just work out what to do with a particular business, I find that 2 or 3 hours on a bike is a brilliant way of clearing your head. So I love it. I mean, I play tennis and I swim in the summer, and, you know, we've got the sea nearby. So I do plenty of exercise. But I find it very difficult to switch off. I mean, we started this talk with this conversation with how do you do lots of different things. Well, one of the things I've found is that I can switch from one to the next. I can engage in a conversation. I mean, my problem is I find it quite difficult to re-engage. So you get very, very involved in a particular issue, and then you move on to another subject, another business, another organisation, and then 3 weeks later you're asked to go back to the one that you got very heated about. And unless there's someone there to sort of remind you of everything that went on and all the conversations, I've kind of switched off. So, you know, I find it easy to sleep. There are times when I worry about things, inevitably, but I think I'm lucky in that respect. So I find, you know, I love travelling, and then, you know, I think it is good to switch off. We've just been to India for 2 weeks, and I think going away for a long period of time. We went to the Andaman Islands, where, you know, you go to places where the connectivity is poor. The Andaman Islands have no internet.
Yeah.
And it was quite a shock. You know, it's not about, you know, eventually finding a hotel or a high bit of ground where you can get a connection.
It does not exist,
and actually very refreshing.
Yeah. Right, so it's 1 minute soapbox time. So this is giving guests an opportunity to speak for 1 minute on a subject of their choice. William, do you have an idea in mind?
Well, we've talked a lot about something that I often stand on a soapbox about anyway. So, I mean, right now I'm involved in a campaign which is very close to here and close to my heart, which is that we are having thrust upon us a very large nuclear power station. We always assumed that there would be another nuclear power station. We've got two on our beach a few miles from here already, and we assume there'll be another one. But it turns out that we are about to have one of such enormity built that it would completely devastate everything that we hold dear about this part of East Suffolk, which is a very wild place. You know, it's famous for, you know, it's famous for Minsmere. It's an area of outstanding national beauty. And so the idea that we should have a nuclear power station slapped in the middle of it, so big. And the plan was it was going to be built from the sea, like Sizewell B. But Sizewell C apparently can't be built from the sea for reasons which I suspect are, you know, pretty sensible. And so the plan is to build it from the roads. But as you will know from coming up here, we have no roads. We have a single track A12. Hinkley Point, which is having problems already, has the M5 nearly up to its front door, and it's being built from the sea. So I am very engaged with many of my neighbours in trying to, not to stop it, but to remind EDF that we are not going to take it lying down, and we are going to fight on our particular beach to prevent an inappropriate building. And if they can build it appropriately, then we'll support them.
Brilliant. And finally, what advice would you give to someone looking to start up a food, drink or farming business?
Well, most important advice would be, you know, go for it. There are loads and loads of people who are starting businesses all the time. Some of them come to me and say, what do you think of my idea? I've never seen an early idea which is brilliant. Most of them are half good. Yeah. Some of them are less than half good. It's all about having staying power. You need enough money to do what you're trying to do. So if it's an ambitious project, you probably need some money from outside. If it's a simple project which you can fund yourself, then take a a longer time doing it. Don't give up your day job, but keep listening to see, you know, which bits are working, which bits aren't working. Invest time and money in the bits that are working. Gather people around you, because I've never seen a successful business that's built by one person. They're built by teams. So if you're not a good team player, you're probably not the right person to be doing it. So it's simple things, but you know, most ideas work in the end. Most, you know, the statistics suggest that most businesses fail. Well, they most businesses fail under the owners, but they get picked up by other people. So most ideas succeed. So you know, it's a long game, and you need to make sure that you're prepared for that long game.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to raise a glass of kombucha and say thank you very much for having me today. It's been a fascinating chat.
The entrepreneur William Kendall. Next time, I'm heading to Cambridgeshire to speak to Georgie Bray, who is the farm manager at the RSPB's Hope Farm. I hope you can join me then. In the meantime, you can catch all previous episodes at thinkingcountry.com and the last 10 episodes on iTunes, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Please do tell your family and friends about the podcast. It'd be great to have them on board as well. And I'll look forward to you joining me next time.